Good morning, everyone.
I am the first moderator today. My name is Jonathan Paquin. I'm from Laval University. I'm a political scientist and a research associate at the Programme Paix Sécurité Internationale of the same university. So welcome again to this first panel, Law and Counterinsurgency. We have a great panel this morning. Our main speaker, Marco Sassoli from Université de Genève, will have about 25 minutes to do his presentation. And we have three commentators this morning. The first one, Or Arthur Onig, from the Center for Military and Strategic Studies at the University of Calgary. We have Brigadier General Dennis Thompson from the Canadian Forces. Good morning. And Marie-Joëlle Zahar from the Research Group on International Security at Université de Montréal. So without further delay, I'm going to ask Mr. Sassoli to come up. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Bonjour et merci beaucoup de m'avoir invité à Ottawa pour cette conférence très intéressante. Vu que je viens de Suisse, je n'ai pas encore les habitudes canadiennes et la capacité de dire en 25 minutes en même temps en français et en anglais la même chose. And therefore, as I assume that some people would lose some issues if I was not speaking English, I will speak in English also. This is no prejudice to my profound ideas about francophonie. The subject of our panel is law and counterinsurgency. I think law makes the difference between war and crime, because how you commit a crime is not regulated by rules, while how you wage war is regulated by rules. And I think both the insurgents and the counterinsurgents have an interest that insurgency and counterinsurgency is regulated by rules. The subject is mainly, as printed in the program, is counterinsurgency, while I will speak mainly about insurgency. Nevertheless, I thought it is necessary to say some words about the law applicable to counterinsurgency. The two branches of international law protecting people affected by insurgency and counterinsurgency are international humanitarian law, or the laws of war, on the one hand, and human rights law on the other hand. For both branches, there are certain obstacles to their applicability in such situations. For human rights law, first, some people contest its application beyond the territory of a state. That's the whole debate about extraterritorial application of human rights law. In addition, even those who recognize it question when it becomes applicable extraterritorially. The second reason for for claiming that human rights law is not applicable is that some counterinsurgency situations are claimed to be attributable only to an international organization like the UN or NATO, and then the state says we don't have human rights obligations because it's not us, it's them. And as some of you may know, even the European Court of Human Rights in relation with Kosovo has accepted, astonishingly, this theory. And finally, there is the UN Charter, Article 103, which says that obligations under the Charter prevail over any other international obligation. And some people say that the authorization by the Security Council authorizes also to act not in conformity with international humanitarian law or human rights law. In my view, this would only be the case if the Security Council explicitly was asking to violate human rights law and humanitarian law, which is never the case, while one must presume that if the Security Council authorizes the use of force, this force has to be used in conformity with the law applicable to such use of force. For humanitarian law, the main obstacle is that humanitarian law applies only to armed conflicts, and therefore you have to define a situation as armed conflict before humanitarian law becomes applicable. And then, as you know, there are two kinds of armed conflict, international and non-international armed conflicts. Well, insurgency and counterinsurgency logically are nearly always non-international armed conflict. Now, if both branches, human rights law and humanitarian law, apply, the question is which prevails. Most of the time, both go into the same direction, and therefore it doesn't matter. Simply one or the other provides more detail. Obviously, they have separate and distinct mechanisms of implementation, and there is a certain tendency to use the more efficient mechanisms of human rights law, at least for individuals. They can, in Europe, for instance, go before the European Court of Human Rights. And therefore, one always tries to bring humanitarian law problems before a human rights body, because the individual has a standing in human rights on human rights issues. On the substance, however, in my view, the only two issues on which there are real differences in counterinsurgency are the two crucial issues of attacks and detention. Who and when may an insurgent be killed, and under what procedures may an insurgent be detained? On the attack issue, the two positions, extreme positions, are on the one hand those who want to apply to non-international armed conflict, by analogy, the law of international armed conflict, and therefore say an insurgent may be attacked like an enemy combatant at any time until he or she surrenders or is hors de combat by wounds and so on. And the other extreme position is to say non-international armed conflict is completely different and there is no rule on this, and therefore we have to apply human rights law, and under human rights law, obviously, you may not deliberately kill someone except in extreme situations, and you have to first try to arrest that person, and in the proportionality and in the precautionary measures to be taken, you have also to take into account the interest of the target, which is not the case in humanitarian law. Very shortly, my opinion is that it depends which of the two prevails of the situation, whether the individual situation of use of force is more similar to that for which the laws of war were made or of human rights law were made. So if a Taliban is arrested in the middle of Kabul, it's not an issue of warfare but of human rights law, while if it is in the fighting somewhere in a contested region, it's more an issue of humanitarian law. On detention, the two extreme positions are again that under the law of international armed conflict, an enemy prisoner of war may be detained without any judicial procedure until the end of the conflict. If you apply that by analogy to non-international armed conflicts, this would mean that insurgents do not benefit from a judicial procedure except if they are tried for a crime. The other extreme position is that insurgents are clearly under the jurisdiction of the state detaining them, and therefore habeas corpus is non-derogable. I have a certain tendency to prefer the second position, although one has always to check whether this is realistic on the battlefield, and there I see some problems. On the other hand, it's very difficult to apply by analogy the rule of international armed conflict, because in international armed conflict you know who is a member of the enemy armed forces, while here you would need a procedure to determine whether the person you arrested is really an insurgent or a harmless civilian. But now I come to the subject I promised to deal with, which is insurgency. International law, despite all modern theories, is still a legal order very much obsessed by states, between states. And this is why it has difficulty to apply to many modern phenomena like transnational enterprises, NGOs, terrorist groups, armed groups. You see, I put very varied people together, but structurally it's the same thing. There are non-state actors which become more and more important in international reality, while international law is still very much state-centered. Well, I have to say that under the Geneva Conventions, armed groups, insurgents, are clearly addressees of Article 3 common of the Geneva Conventions, saying in the case of an armed conflict not of an international character occurring in the territory of one of the high contracting parties, each party, capital P, to the conflict shall be bound to apply, which means both the government and the insurgents and those helping the government have to comply with exactly the same rules of humanitarian law. Beyond Article 3 common, which is just one article of the Geneva Conventions, it is often Protocol Additional 2 to the Geneva Conventions, which applies if the insurgents have territorial control and the territorial state is a party to Protocol 2. And today it is claimed that most of the rules of customary law are the same for international and non-international armed conflicts. In the ICSC study of 2005, 141 out of 161 rules are claimed to be the same in international and non-international armed conflicts. And this leads me to a little excursus on the excursion on an issue which I think is important. We have in developing humanitarian law, in interpreting humanitarian law, in discussing about humanitarian law, be careful that if it is law of non-international armed conflict, it must remain realistic for armed groups, because unrealistic rules don't protect anyone. I'm very humanitarian, but if I have to choose between a humanitarian rule and a realistic rule, I prefer the realistic rule, because the humanitarian rule doesn't protect anyone if it is not realistic. So we have to check whether the rules of the law of non-international armed conflict are realistic for insurgents, because otherwise they will not respect them. Bona fide insurgents, let's assume this is the case. By the way, we do that also with humanitarian law generally. I mean, we always check whether it's realistic for the military. And if the military must say, this is a nice rule, but we cannot fight with these rules, then we have to find another rule, because otherwise it is useless, the rule we produce. I give you three examples of doubts from very different fields of humanitarian law, which show you the problem. And in my view, those who discuss about humanitarian law often forget the other side. And this is why I put the emphasis today on this issue. First, in the ICSC customary law study, there is a nice rule saying prohibiting arbitrary detention. And this is, they say, applicable in international and non-international armed conflict. Now, if it is a rule of the law of non-international armed conflict, it also binds insurgents. And the study explains that not to be arbitrary, a detention must have a legal basis, and the individual must be able to challenge the lawfulness of the detention. Those who wrote this, did they think about insurgents? How will insurgents legislate? For whom will they legislate? How can they be obliged to legislate? And how will insurgents institute a habeas corpus proceeding? Because if it is humanitarian law, it also binds the insurgent. A second example comes from international criminal law. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia has held that the principle of and the rules on command responsibility apply to both international and non-international armed conflict. Why in the treaties it's only for international armed conflict? This sounds reasonable, but for an insurgent commander, what does that mean? He's not in the same situation than a military commander of governmental forces. Often he has less contact with his subordinates, and in particular, the obligation to punish violations, which is a part of command responsibility, raises again the question, well, how can they punish? I heard the diplomat saying, okay, they can hand over the one who violated humanitarian law to the governmental justice system. Well, this is not realistic. Forget about it. Another example, my last one, which is also a proposal, forget about it, is about child soldiers. Today you do no longer speak about child soldiers, but children involved in armed conflict. And all professional do-gooders agree that it's not only child soldiers, it's not only those who directly participate in hostilities, but in particular because of gender considerations, every child who is involved with an armed group. Under the old Cape Town principles, there was still an exception for children who are involved in an armed group together with their parents. Under the Paris principles and the UNICEF definition, this exception does no longer appear. And I discussed with a diplomat involved in the process in the Security Council about children involved in armed conflict, who simply said, okay, if parents want to join an armed group, they have to put the child into a government orphanage. Remember, child is until 16, 15 or 18 years, there are all controversies. Well, please don't ask me to convince an armed group to comply with this rule. Imagine the PKK, which is fighting against Turkey for the Kurdish culture. If I tell the PKK fighters, put your children into a Turkish orphanage. Simply, they don't want to have their children to have a Turkish education and so on. Okay. Now, the core of the rules, nevertheless, is realistic and applies, but the question is how do we enforce them against armed groups and with armed groups? The first step also, as I read to you, in according to Article 3 Common, the rules of humanitarian law already are addressed to armed groups. It is preferable to have the armed group buying in, to have them committing themselves to the rules, which also creates, somehow advocates within the armed groups for the rules. This is particularly important for rules which are not addressed to armed groups. For instance, the Ottawa Convention on Antipersonal Landmines is only addressed to states. And this is a field where an NGO I have the honor to chair the board of, Geneva Call, tries to get a deed of commitment by armed groups, which is very solemnly signed in the at the seat of the government of Geneva in the Alabama room in Geneva. The armed group signs and then starts the process of engagement. And obviously, with insurgents, it's easier to bring them to respect some rules if you can show your commanders have signed that they want to comply. But it's only the starting of the idea. Another possibility which is foreseen by humanitarian law is an agreement between governmental forces and insurgents to apply certain rules. Personally, I think also codes of conduct are very useful. When an armed group declares it will comply with the Geneva Conventions and additional protocols, I am very skeptical because that's much too much for them. While What is more serious, if they translate these rules into, say, two pages of rules which are actually relevant for the group, what it means in the language of the group, where the fighters feel it's their commander who wants that, and not the guy from Geneva who comes with a prepared commitment and say, please sign here, because then it will have no impact. Okay, then you need dissemination, and there I think we should also think more how you can disseminate appropriately humanitarian law without within an armed group. Most armed groups, you don't have 3 months of basic training. It goes very fast, and it's certainly not through PowerPoint presentations by outsiders that you will train them in respecting humanitarian law. Personally, I also think advisory services would be important, because an armed group, I imagine myself always to be the legal advisor of an armed group, the commander of which says, I want to comply with this law, but don't tell me I shall not make war, because that's not the prescription of IHL. I want to make war, but comply with these rules. And then you must have solutions for such insurgents, for instance, on the issue how they can punish their own members who do not comply, not cutting hands and so on, but you must have solutions. And also how you can legislate for the population under control of the armed group, because otherwise it's pure arbitrariness if these people don't know in advance what rules of behavior they are expected to comply with. And then comes the issue of rewarding compliance. In the law of international armed conflict, if I'm a combatant and I comply with the rules, I have an interest, because I will be a prisoner of war, and I will be only interned and released at the end of active hostilities, while if I violate IHL, I will and must be punished for such violations. Obviously, in a non-international armed conflict, say, if I create a fictitious freed Prince Edward's Island movement, and I make war against the government of Canada, even if I perfectly comply with IHL, I wear a uniform, I kill only Canadian soldiers, I perfectly respect the civilian population, once I'm falling in the hands of the Canadian forces, I will be tried for murder, high treason, and so on. So there's no difference whether I kill civilians or I comply with the law. And we must find means of rewarding compliance with humanitarian law. Some recent proposals on the definition of terrorism go in the opposite direction. The Western position, including into the definition of terrorism attacks against government agents and government property with the aim to make a government or an international organization do or not do something, which is completely lawful under IHL, this is the very essence of any warfare, means that acts which are not unlawful under IHL are labeled as acts of terrorism, and this is not encouraging respect of IHL. Okay, then we need monitoring, because obviously the group may make nice declarations, then you have to check whether the group does it. The ICSE can offer its services, and if it is accepted, it monitors the respect by a group. We in Geneva call on a very limited field, which is antipersonal landmines and now child soldiers. We try to do the same, and until now, I must say, from 39 armed groups which have signed a deed of commitment, we had only 2 serious allegations of violations, and we were unable to check them because the government did not accept. The armed group always accepted. Obviously, then comes nevertheless responsibility. If there are violations, the members of the group have a criminal responsibility, there is the civil responsibility, and there is an international responsibility. The Security Council, for instance, has adopted sanctions against
armed groups. Personally, I think humanitarian organizations should also think about how do we react to violations of international humanitarian law, and if possible, they should coordinate to avoid that if one organization moves out, the other moves in, because then the armed group is not very much deterred. Okay, so you will say, well, this is completely unrealistic. He is crazy. From a state-oriented point of view, you will consider me to be crazy. Well, I would like to underline that I'm not a fanatic of armed groups. The world without armed groups would be a better world. But it's a reality. It's like war. I'm not a fanatic of war, but war is a reality, and therefore those who have made humanitarian law, they wanted to have some rules for this unfortunate reality. And armed groups are an unfortunate reality, but if we want to protect people who are threatened by armed groups, we need rules for them. And these rules, as all rules of humanitarian law, will only be respected by the parties, in dialogue with the parties. You have to engage the parties. Some people say, okay, we have to make distinctions. We have to distinguish between acceptable and non-acceptable groups. I think this is a non-starter, first of all, because it's very difficult to define what is acceptable. Please mention to me a group which never violates humanitarian law. By the way, please mention a state which doesn't violate humanitarian law. And if you include terrorist groups, well, perhaps these groups just need most, their victims need most that we engage the group. And there's a diplomatic problem, because if we tell Colombia that the FARC are an acceptable group, but say Hezbollah are not an acceptable group, then Colombia will never accept it, because every government considers the groups against which it is fighting terrorist groups. And all this, fortunately, I can report to you, is not only my dream, but the UN Secretary General, in its latest report on protection of the civilian population in armed conflict, devotes 7 out of 70 paragraphs to the necessity to engage positively and not only to exclude armed groups. I think this is the new frontier of international humanitarian law. Humanitarian law will become irrelevant if it does not succeed to engage also armed groups, because more than half of all parties of armed conflicts and those who create violations, provoke and commit violations of humanitarian law are armed groups. Thank you very much.
Alors, merci beaucoup, professeur Sassoli.